اوكي بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, as we decided, I'm not going to use this PowerPoint presentation unless for the maps. And you have the slides before you. So we wouldn't worry about lights and things like that. Just before I start, I want to mention one thing, because last week, I think, there was some sort of a concern here about some of the discussions. I just want to mention that this is a completely free class. Here, we are here to learn from each other, to put forward ideas, and to challenge those ideas. I mean, you could challenge me, I could challenge you, if I can, and in this way, we can somehow push forward the knowledge that we have. And all of us can learn from each other, so we shouldn't get upset from arguments, from discussions. Well, no argument, but discussions and challenge your ideas. And please, any idea that comes to your mind, please say it aloud. Express it. If it's related to the topic, we'll discuss it. If not, we try to somehow just touch upon it, and that's all. So no one should get concerned about ideas being put forward or challenged, inshallah. Now, we were talking about religion in Arabia before Islam, and if you look into slide 26, that should be on page 13, because there are two slides in one page. So their belief in angel, we discussed about their belief in Allah and their belief in idols, and now they had a very strange belief in angels, and they thought, in most cases, they thought that angels were daughters of God. First of all, they thought that they are daughters, they are female, and then they thought that they are daughters of God. And this appears in many verses of the Quran. For example, in Surah Safat, فَاسْتَفْتِهِمْ أَلِرَبِّكَ الْبَنَاتِ وَلَهُمُ الْبَنُونَ. So ask them whether your Lord has daughters and they have sons. أَمْ خَلَقْنَا الْمَلَائِكَةَ إِنَاثًا وَهُمْ شَاهِدُونَ. Did they witness that we created the angels to be females? And then the verse which is very much related to what I want to say, أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ مِنْ إِفْكِهِمْ لَيَقُولُونَ وَلَدَ اللَّهِ. From out of their lies, they say that God has given birth. Given birth, of course, to the angels, وَأَنَّهُمْ لَكَاذِبُونَ. Now, a very funny idea was that God, when he created jinn, he became fond of some of female jinn, and he married them. And then the angels were the creation of a type of marriage relationship between jinn and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I mean, very outrageous idea that they had developed. And this is mentioned also in Surah Safat as well. وَجَعَلُوا بَيْنَهُ وَبَيْنَ الْجِنَّةِ نَسَبًا. Of course, this is according to one of the interpretations of this verse. They have made a relationship between him and the jinn. And of course, وَلَقَدْ عَلِمَتِ الْجِنَّةُ إِنَّهُمْ لَمُخْبَرُونَ. Jinn themselves know that such a thing is not true, and they are going to be summoned for being held accountable for what they do. So this was another very funny idea that they had. The other issue that we have to discuss about their religion is their ideas regarding the hereafter. It's very interesting, because when we put this concept into picture, then we can grasp the type of ideas that they had regarding their idols. They definitely did not believe that any world exists after this world. You shouldn't think that these ideas are very new. For example, people come out and say it's evolution now, and we have been created just out of nothing. These are very, very old ideas. And Quran mentions this as something which belongs to people of the very, very old age. They believe that there is no hereafter whatsoever. This is mentioned in Surah Jasiyah. وَقَالُوا مَا هِيَ إِلَّا حَيَاتُنَا الدُّنْيَا نَمُوتُ وَنَحْيَا. Of course, this is only one sample. In many, many verses, they reiterate this. وَقَالُوا مَا هِيَ إِلَّا حَيَاتُنَا الدُّنْيَا نَمُوتُ وَنَحْيَا وَمَا يُحْلِكُنَا إِلَّا الدَّهْرُ. And they say there is nothing but our life in this world. We live and die and nothing destroys us but time. Now, dahr, of course, it is something more than time. It means the process of today we say evolution. But then they said dahr. And they were called dahriyun. They were very famous people. Before Islam, they were called dahriyun. People who did not believe that anything exists beyond this world. For human beings, they believed that in supernatural things, but they did not believe that there is any hereafter. Now, you might say that, why did they worship God then? Or why did they worship their idols? Because we worship God and we worship whatever we worship because of our hereafter. Now, the idolaters, usually, they only worship their idols for the sake of gaining benefits for this world. And especially this becomes even more strange when they said هؤلاء شفعاؤنا عند الله ما نعبدهم إلا ليقربونا إلى الله زلفا. These are our shufa'a, our intercessors, and we worship them so that they bring us closer to Allah. Now, why do they want to become closer to Allah if there is no life after death? Just for the worldly benefits. They just wanted to become closer to these gods and to Allah that they thought is something like those idols, a little bit bigger, they wanted to gain more benefits out of it. And therefore, I don't think any one of us could put themselves in place of one of those idolaters when they worship God or when they worship their idols. Because usually when we want to worship, become closer, become spiritual, we don't think about this world, we think about the next world. Now imagine someone who does not believe in next world at all, but they are religious. At the same time they are religious, they believe in God, and they believe in gods. So what type of religion that might have been? So this is again one verse in Surah Duhan. إِنَّ هَؤُلَاءِ لَيَقُولُونَ إِنْ هِيَ إِلَّا مَوْتَتُنَا الْأُولَى وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمُنْشَرِينَ. They say that there is not but our first death, and we shall not be raised. When we die, we just perish. That's all. And of course, فَأْتُوا بِآبَائِنَا. This was their most forceful argument. فَأْتُوا بِآبَائِنَا إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. Bring back our fathers. If you say there is any life after death, bring back our fathers. Something that usually in our own language we say, who has seen the next world? Who has come back from that world? This is what they usually said to each other. And in Surah Yasin, of course, وَضَرَبَ لَنَا مَثَلًا وَنَسْيَ خَلْقَهُ. He brought an example for us, forgot how we have created him, that he brought a bone, and then قَالَ مَنْ يُحْيَ الْعَذَامَ وَهِيَرًا. Who can make this, give this life again? So, this was their idea about hereafter. Now, you might say, if they did not believe in anything beyond this world, and if they were so material type of people, then how did they manage to keep a social order? How did human merits develop? Because they had lots of merits. We shouldn't actually think that they were vicious people. They weren't vicious people. Many of them were very good people with lots of merits. That, for example, hosting guests, being very good hosts for guests, helping other people, protecting their family and their kings, having great respect for parents, for Salatul Rahim, and all these things they had. Now, if there was no religion, how did these develop? And this is very interesting about the Arabs at that time. They had a firm belief in something called Murawwah. Murawwah is from Mar'ah, and Mar'ah means man. not manliness in that sense, something more than that, something which made a person to be humane. That's what they called muruwa or futuwa. Or futuwa means to be, fata is young man, a person who has qualities of protecting others, being caring, considerate, and these things. This is what they regarded as one of the most favorable merits. And there were some people among them. We'll come to this later on when we talk about the youth era of the Prophet. There were some, once some of the businessmen came from outside Mecca and he sold something. And you know, people coming from outside, they didn't have any tribe there to protect them. And if the people who bought those things didn't want to pay them, no one could help them. There was no police force or nothing like that. So someone came and sold something. I don't remember to whom now. Inshallah, I'll discuss this later on when we come to that position. He sold it and the person didn't want to pay. To Abu Jahl or someone. Now, the man didn't have any tribe there to... No judge would have actually ruled anything against a local person. So he just went on Abu Qubays and shouted, "Isn't there anyone to help me?" Three people or more, who were all of them called Fazl ibn Fulan and Fazl ibn Fulan, they came together, they said that, "Where is our Muruwa?" And they created a pact, and that was called Helful Fuzul, the pact of the three fathers, Helful Fuzul. And in that pact, they wrote some articles that we protect anyone who's oppressed in Mecca and have no tribe. We help anyone who comes here and loses their property, they lose their property and cannot go back. And many, many articles, we will go through that. And one of the people who signed to that pact was the Prophet, peace be on him, although he was very young. And so this type of attitude of muruwa or futuwa, it was there. And they boasted very much for this reason. In a way, they boasted, and there is a verse in the Quran which shows that they really said, we follow the merits of our fathers. And if there is any merit in Islam, we would have followed Islam. In Surah Ahqaf, وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَوْ كَانَ خَيْرًا مَا سَبَقُونَ إِلَيْهِ. The kuffar say to the believers, if this religion had any merit, no one could go ahead of us in this. We would have been the first people who would believe in it, but there is no merit in this. The merit that, of course, Islam supported very much, they said, no, there is no merit in this. And in a way, many verses of the Quran which advises us to have some merits, like for example, بِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا وَبِذِ الْقُرْبَى وَالْيَتَامَى, these were the things that very well accommodated itself in the heart of the Arabs, because they were that type of people who wanted to be like that. Although they did not believe in any hereafter or something like that, but they commended very much, they respected these type of concepts and attitudes. Now, one other thing that we have to mention about those days is the people who were respected, they didn't have any priest or anything like that. The idols, they didn't need any priest. And there were, of course, people who looked after the properties, the endowments, because there were lots of endowments for idols and such things. But there weren't priests as we could define it as such. However, there were some people who were related somehow to the spiritual world, and they called them kahin. Kahin, a soothsayer, or type of ecstatic prophet who sometimes made connection with the world of jinn and received some news. And these were the people who on whom people of Arabia relied very much. And of course, the first thing that they said, this prophet, our prophet, they said he's a kahan, just like other kahana. As when Musa went to Pharaoh with those miracles, Musa said, well, this is not a big deal. We have lots of magicians here who can do greater magics than you are. They said to our prophet that you are the same. I mean, these people have some sort of connection with the world of jinn. You have found one of those connections. These people have not destroyed our religion. Why do you want to destroy our religion? You are not anyone new. And these kahins usually, for example, anyone coming to Mecca for Hajj, these kahins came to Mecca as well. And people came to them and they showed them their children, they showed them their families to see, to get some news about their future, for example. And there's one nice story about Halima. We'll discuss about her, the foster mother of the Prophet and the Prophet. Once a kahin went to the area of Bani Sa'd where the Prophet was being brought up, and people brought their children so that he could say something about it, or she was a kahina. And Halima took the Prophet, and as soon as that lady looked at the Prophet, she was very scared and said, kill this child, he is going to change your religion. And Halima just snatched it and ran away so that people would not think about it twice, that what that kahina said about the Prophet. So this was very common. And also they had great respect for poets. And that's why poetry became very important at that time. And they thought that poets had a supernatural type of ability to connect to the world of jinn again. So, well, when they said jinn, they meant anything supernatural. And they were inspired by them. And otherwise they couldn't have said these beautiful words. And you can see when the Quran came, again, one other thing they said, the Prophet is, they said he's a shair. Again, attached to some sort of world. Now, many things that Orientalists have said about our prophets, a soothsayer, a schizophrenic person, someone with mental disorder, all these things were mentioned by the people at that time, and they are quoted in the Quran. That's very interesting, because the Quran quotes all those things. Now, look at these verses from Surah 2. فذكر فما أنت بنعمة ربك بكاهن ولا مجنون. Now مجنون means someone who's hit by a jinn or who has become mad because what we call a schizophrenic person, because of some mental disorder. Now continue to be mindful, by the grace of your Lord, you are not a soothsayer, not a kahin, and or a madman. Or do they say, a poet, أَمْ يَقُولُونَ شَاعِرٌ نَتَرَبَّسُ بِهِ رَيْبَ الْمَنُونَ. We wait for him, the evil accident of time. Well, just leave him, he will die himself and everything will go. Say, wait, for surely I too with you am of those who wait. Nay, do their understanding bid them this, أَمْ تَأْمُرُهُمْ أَحْلَامُهُمْ بِهَذَا. Does their intellect say such things to them about you? Do they really judge you like that? Do they really speak like a kahin? Do they speak like a sha'ir? Or are they an inordinate people? Or do they say he has forged it? Another thing, that no, he's completely sane. He's neither a sha'ir nor a kahin. He is a knowledgeable man. And he has forged all these. أَمْ يَقُولُونَ تَقَوَّلَهُ فَلْيَأْتُوا بِحَدِيثٍ مِثْلِهِ إِنْ كَانُوا صَادِقِينَ. So let them bring something similar. All those literate people among them come together and say something similar, which of course they couldn't. Now, the Quran, of course, attacks kahins, because this type of practice was not acceptable. And we know that at the time of the Prophet, when the Prophet was given the mission, or when he was born, the Kahans lost their contact with their whatever they had, the jinn. And the jinn themselves said in Surah Al-Jinn that previously we used to get some information about future, but now when we go to get those informations, we are tortured and punished, and we cannot find anything. And they came back. So this issue of Kahana and soothsaying in Arabia completely vanished after the Prophet. The second thing, Quran attacks Shu'ara. Well, and of course, in that environment, attacking poets was something really strange. In Surah Shu'ara, وَالشُعَرَاء يَتَّبِعُهُمُ الْغَاوُونَ, only those who go astray follow the Shu'ara, the poets. أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّهُمْ فِي كُلَّ وَادٍ يَحِيمُونَ. Do you not see? They just go in every direction. وَإِنَّهُمْ لَيَقُولُونَ, contemplation, imagination, all these things, saying things which have no reality. وَإِنَّهُمْ يَقُولُونَ مَا لَا يَفْعَلُونَ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالَحَاتِ. Of course, if you want to be a poet, you have to be a believer. Do good. And then use your poetry for the sake of your idea. A committed type of art you can use. But just saying poetry for the sake of poetry, which was very common at that time, that was the leisure of the time, actually. In Mina, when people went for Hajj, the only thing they did, they just listened to the poet. And it was a type, like for example, the type of fascination that people have nowadays about some sort of art, cinema, TV, they had about this poetry. And of course, Quran mentions, Quran forbade when they went to Mina to recite poetry. And in Ramadan, for example, it's makruh to recite any poetry. Although it's a good poetry, they say, no, don't go in that area. Because that's an area which rests on lots of false imagination. And about Mina, فَإِذَا قَضَيْتُم مَنَاسِكَكُمْ, when you have finished your manasik, when you have done your qurbani, don't go and listen to poets. فَذْكُرُوا اللَّهَ كَذِكْرِكُمْ آبَائِكُمْ. Because when they came and recited those poems, they all talked about their forefathers, who they were, what they did. So Quran says, فَذْكُرُوا اللَّهَ كَذِكْرِكُمْ آبَائِكُمْ. The way you mention your fathers, you remember God. أَوْ أَشَدَّ ذِكْرًا, or more than that. You remember God the way you remember your fathers, or more than that. And therefore, the whole spiritual type of ideas which were around at that time, Quran somehow changed or shifted or completely destroyed it. About the Kahans, about the Shire, it gave it a shift. And one, in this context, we realize how important it was for the Prophet that he never ever recited one line of poetry before Quran and after Quran. He never could recite poetry. And this was amazing, of course, for many people, because someone who never had any experience of poetry, he couldn't even repeat a line of poetry that he had heard from others. Someone like that brings something like the Quran, something which was fascinating, because you know, anyone who wants to bring a new style of poetry or prose or whatever, they should know the previous, the old types very well, so that they could change it, they bring a new style or method. But Quran coming from someone who never knew anything of poetry, وَمَا عَلَّمْنَاهُ شَعْرَ, we have not taught him poetry. One line of poetry Prophet recited once, and he recited it wrongly, and Abu Bakr corrected him, and he said, this poem was not recited, was not composed like this, it was composed in another way. And of course Prophet said, well, I don't know poetry, God has not taught me poetry. Okay, now I want to go to political situation. We dealt with religion, and now we want to deal with politics. Now, Thanks God, that land was a desert in which no one had any aspiration. No kingdom, no empire ever thought that they want to go and take that land for themselves. I mentioned last week that when Saif ibn Ziyazan went to the king of Fars, Khosrow Parviz or Kasra, when he went to him and asked, not Khosrow Parviz, Kasra before him, when he asked help, he said, why should I send my troops to that barren land? What's the benefit of it? Now, Yemen, of course, was the best part of that that subcontinent. The lands upper, when we came to the upper part of the Arabian Peninsula, not subcontinent peninsula, when we come up upper part, there was nothing there much. No wealth, no cultivation, no considerable livestock, and that is why we can think why actually Prophet could flourish in that area. Because that was an area without a king, without an emperor, without a deep-rooted culture like culture of Rome or Iran or Egypt. And it was very easy for the Prophet to gain power there. In any other place, it was impossible for him to gain power. Because he would have been finished right at the beginning, because there was a very, very strong central power there. Now here, there wasn't. Of course, the politics of the whole area of the peninsula, we had two protectorates, two simple, small, dependent states. One in the east, one in the northeast, one in the south, in the northwest. One of them depending on the Roman Empire, the other depending on the Iranian Empire. And they were actually there just to keep an eye on that peninsula so that it is not suddenly overtaken by someone else. They were actually just keeping an eye. It was no use for them to go and capture the whole land. Now these two were called Qassani and Lakhmiz. Now let me put this on. If you'd like to just turn the light for a few minutes, please. Now, here, if you look at my cursor, please. Here in this area, this was the area which was just in the vicinity of the Roman Empire, Damascus. Of course, if you look at the map, this is Madinatul Munawwara, and this is Mecca, yeah? And then we have Ta'if. And this map is very good because it mentions the different tribes, the location of different tribes. Of course, I'm going to discuss about it soon. But now this is a better map. Here in northwest, we have a very small protectorate, which is depicted here in a larger scale. This is Dawlatul Qasasana, the Qassanis. These were, of course, there were different Arab tribes, but of course they had a central government here. They were dependent on the Roman Empire, and of course they were there so that if Iranians wanted to attack the peninsula, to inform the Roman Empire, and they would have attacked it as well. There was no use for the land itself, but strategically, of course, neither Roman Empire nor the Iranian Empire wanted the interference of the other in a very considerable way. Here we have Al-Munadhara, this Al-Munzir, Dawlatul Munadhara. They were called Al-Lakhmiyun, Dawlatul Munadhara or Lakhmiyun. So I have written there Qassanis and Lakhmiyun. These were, of course, attached to Iran, and they were also careful that nothing happens there. And in the south, we had Yemen. Here it was Yemen, and this is Najran, of which we talked previously, and Sana'a, which was the capital of Yemen. And then, of course, this was Oman, and then this is the Jaziratul Arab. Now, the whole Jaziratul Arab, except Mecca and Medina. Now, of course, Medina was a bit well-to-do because of the palm trees that it had, some farming that they had. Mecca, of course, because it was the business route and also the center for pilgrimage. Apart from these two cities, we had small city-states for the tribes. When I say city-states, of course, not big cities. The tribes had their power concentrated in different areas. Now, here, for example, in around Mecca, we have Quraysh, and when we come further down south, we have At-Ta'if, in which Hawazin and Thaqif lived, which, of course, we had the Battle of Hunayn here, a very, very fearful battle later on for Prophet to capture Ta'if after the conquest of Mecca. And then we have Khuza'a between Mecca and Medina. And in Medina, we had Aws and Khazraj. And we go a little bit higher, Ghatafan, and this is Khaybar, this is Fadak. Of course, these were areas in which the Jews were living. And, of course, here is Tabuk, where the Battle of Tabuk, very famous, of course, wanted to take place, which it didn't. And then we have other tribes, Hanifa, Bani Hanifa, Tamim, Asad, Rabi'a, Rabi'at ibn Bakr, and others who, and Hamdan, the very famous tribe from Yemen, Murad, Bani Murad, were here in the south. So, we didn't have a very strong central government. There were city-states. All these tribes were independently run, autonomous, completely autonomous. Quraysh didn't have any authority on, for example, Hawazin or Thaqif. They had autonomous power for themselves. Or, for example, Aws and Khazraj didn't have any authority on Quraysh. Quraysh didn't have any authority on Aws and Khazraj. If we analyze the whole issue a little bit in our mind, we will find that this was the best setting for a prophet to come and create a central power. And something that would have gone with the least bloodshed. I mean, if this wanted to happen in Rome or in Iran or in Egypt, half of the population should have been killed because of the resistance which came forth. But here, of course, it went very smoothly. Of course, Quraysh did not accept the Prophet. Prophet just migrated to Aws and Khazraj. They accommodated the Prophet among themselves. And then, of course, everything took on from there. Now, one thing I wanted to show you last week that which I couldn't. When I talked about Hashem, I talked about the routes going from Mecca to Sham and then to Medina. This is the route going from Mecca. Of course, this is down there is Mecca. Going from Mecca to Sham. This was the route for Rehlatu Saif. When they traveled during the summer, they went to Sham. They just went by the shore to, of course, this was the best way to go to Sham, to Syria. So you would see that Medina was not on the way at all. On the way from Mecca to Sham, Medina was not on the way. And therefore, people who really had a business in Medina would have left this route going to Medina. The route for Medina was, of course, different. This green route that you see here, green line, this was the route to Medina. And of course, when we come to the Hijra of the Prophet, there is a very beautiful map. You will see that Prophet did not go on this route. Prophet just went zigzag. He didn't travel on the route because, of course, he was afraid that they are going to capture him. And this is something that we will discuss when we talk about Battle of Badr. The interesting thing is that the caravan was traveling from here, the business caravan, and of course Prophet came down here to intersect the caravan, to confiscate the caravan because they had confiscated the property of people of Mecca, Mu'minun of Mecca. So he wanted to intercept the caravan. They, of course, got the information and they stopped. They didn't want to go further so that the Prophet would intercept them. And an army went from Mecca towards Medina, and here in Badr, when the Prophet had come down, they went there in Badr, they met. Now, I don't know how many of you have visited Badr when they have gone to Mecca or Medina. In old days, the caravans used to take people to Badr. It's a very far away place. But the interesting thing is that this is a very difficult place to find. And Quran mentions, وَلَوْ تَوَاعَدْتُمْ لَخْتَلَفْتُمْ فِي الْمِيَادِ. If you had made an arrangement to meet each other, two armies. Of course, Prophet didn't want to meet the army. Prophet wanted to meet the caravan. And Allah told them, one of the two, either caravan or army, you will take. And of course, every Muslim prayed that, well, we don't meet the army, we meet the caravan. Because that was the easiest thing. And وَإِذْ يَعِدُكُمُ اللَّهُ إِحْدَى الطَّائِفَتَيْنِ أَنَّهَا لَكُمْ. When God promised that one of these two is for yours, you will take it. وَتَوَدُّونَ أَنَّ غَيْرَ ذَاتِ الشَّوْكَةِ تَكُونُ لَكُمْ. And you wanted that the unarmed group will be yours, so that you don't go to a war. But of course, Allah wanted to prove haq. And then you met in a place that it was very strange how you met. وَلَوْ تَوَعَدْتُمْ لَاخْتَلَفْتُمْ فِي الْمِيَادِ. Even if you had arranged to meet there, you wouldn't have found each other. But you saw how strangely you came across each other suddenly in Badr, and that battle took place. We'll discuss about this later on. Just I wanted to show how, of course, Hashim, when he went to Medina and married, he didn't go just on the way. He had intended some business. Usually, the businessmen, some of them did. They wanted to rest in Medina for a couple of weeks. And, I spoke about the city-states. And, sorry, you can turn on the lights now because I finished with the maps. And also, the Qasanis and Lakhmit and Yemen. Of course, Yemen was very important. Yemen was a center of power. However, even Yemen was not very interested in coming and capturing these tribes or fighting against these tribes. There was nothing much there for people to aspire, for kings or for rulers to aspire to come and capture a place. Even, for example, people of Mecca going and capturing Medina, for example. First of all, there was no use. They didn't have that manpower to go and do it and run it. And secondly, there was nothing much. The only, of course, important place was Mecca. And Quraysh was strong enough to support themselves in Mecca. But it was quite an autonomous city, of course. As Medina was an autonomous city. They were not run by any other government. Economy, well, I think I explained about economy. They didn't have anything. It was just the Mecca, because of the business, it had attracted lots of wealth. People had become really, really wealthy in Mecca, while the Bedouins, the other tribes, were in poverty. And of course, the Bedouins, well, they thrived on their camels and some water that they found. Very, very difficult type of life, but they liked it. When I come to the why Prophet was given to be fostered in a Bedouin place, I will discuss why Arabs usually liked their children to be brought up in the desert rather than in the city. And this was a habit among all of them. Even every children which was born in the city, it was given to Bedouins to be brought up and to be fostered by them, because they were very much fond of the culture. The language was beautiful, the language that Bedouins used. Someone asked the Prophet, how come you are so fasih, so eloquent? He said, first of all, I'm from Quraysh. Secondly, I was brought up in Bani Sa'd ibn Bakr. And Bani Sa'd ibn Bakr, from which Halima was coming, was the most eloquent Bedouin tribe in Arab. And mostly, many of the Arabs send their children to be brought up in that environment so that they learn how to pronounce Zad. Of course, not all of us can pronounce Zad, probably. And Prophet said, أَنَا أَفْسَحُ مَنْ تَكَلَّمَ بِالزَّادِ. I am the most eloquent person who can pronounce that. And of course, that was because he was brought up in that Bani Sa'd ibn Bakr. Now, apart from those Bedouins, of course, in cities, there were farming, gardening, palm trees. Some artifacts, artifacts, handicrafts, and nothing more, really. And therefore, as I said, this was a blessing for the whole area. Because when you have wealth, you have thieves. You have people who come and want to plunder you. When you don't have anything, you are relieved. Alhamdulillah, al-muflisu fi amanillah. No one can would like to come and hurt you. And this is how, of course, we find even at not times of very great hardships, not at times of war, we find really people in many areas, they were hungry all the time. Because, of course, there were lack of food, lack of water, and many things that you can imagine in that very, very hot and harsh type of environment. Now, is there any question about this pre-Islamic Arabia? Yes.
I find it very strange that like everybody has their children fostered. What happened to the natural mothers? They didn't want to look after it?
They just rested. Yeah, the natural mothers, of course, the children were brought back after 2 years. Usually, mothers did not milk their children. I don't know why. But the reason that they gave them to be fostered, as I said, they liked the weather in the culture outside the city and the language. And, if you remember, Yazid was sent to a Bedouin tribe to be brought up, not to be fostered. And when Muawiyah died, he was with that Bedouin tribe. And that's why he was very rude, uncultured. When I say culture, of course, there were merits with Bedouins. But, of course, they didn't have the culture of the city. And that's why the children were brought back soon. And after 2 years, 3 years that they were fostered, then they learned the culture of the city as well. But Yazid was a very uncultured person, because he loved to live with Bedouins and hunting and these sort of things. There might be other reasons for that. Women in the, those women who fostered these children were stronger, their milk was better. The type of food which they ate in the deserts gave better strength to those children when they grew up, and many other reasons that they thought about it. So, usually women in the city, they did not milk their children, and they had foster mothers.
You said the time and the right that I guess I understand why then they should generally cross the outrage against the prophet in the general public. It seems as if they have the same rituals and the same concept that the prophet and the prophet have. Why do they say against it?
The same type of ethics, you can say. Morality. But not, of course, the same type of religion. Of course, Prophet was attacking their gods. And you know, religion is the most important thing for any, especially in old days, for any people. So attacking the gods, attacking their traditions was very hard for them. However, this was only for the Quraysh. Usually, they should have accepted it. I mean, it is amazing why Quraysh rejected all these things. And you can see how people of Medina very, very easily accepted it. I mean, this was because, of course, it was very natural for them. The whole idea was natural for them. The only thing it was that it was a bit difficult for them to leave the idols, to leave those concepts. And otherwise, I mean, in a matter of a year or less than that, the whole Medina converted to Islam. And it shows that it appealed to them. Why Quraysh didn't? This is a very, very strange issue. I mean, as the Quran says, وَكَذَّبَ بِهِ قَوْمُكَ your qawm, your people have denied this, while other people had accepted it. And there were some people, very, very stubborn people in Ta'if and in Mecca. You know, Ta'if was the last place that who submitted to the Prophet in a battle, not by their own will. And that was in Battle of Hunayn after the conquest on Mecca. And in that battle, actually, Prophet almost was being killed. And the Muslims lost many people. They were being completely defeated if the help of God did not come. وَلَقَدْ نَصَرَكُمُ اللَّهُ Was that? فِي مَوَاطِنَ كَثِيرَةٍ Allah has helped you in many places. وَيَوْمَ حُنَيْنًا And on the day of Hunayn. إِذَا عَجَبَتْكُمْ كَثْرَتُكُمْ Of course, you were huge odds. Because tens of thousands. The Prophet came to Mecca with 10,000. When, of course, the army attacked Ta'if, people from Mecca had joined, from other places had joined, so there was huge army. إِذَا عَجَبَتْكُمْ كَثْرَتُكُمْ وَلَمْ تُغْنِ عَنْكُمْ شَيْئًا But your number could not do anything for you. And you were almost on the verge of defeat. And you were turning back, then ثُمَّ أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ سَكِينَتَهُ عَلَىٰ رَسُولِهِ وَعَلَىٰ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَأَيَّدَكُمْ بِجُنُودٍ لَمْ تَرَوْهَا God didn't want you to be defeated, so He sent angels to help you. Otherwise, you would have been defeated. So these were very stubborn people. In Mecca, in Ta'if, not in other places. Yes?
You were saying Mecca was a rich city. Could it be that these people have something to lose?
Of course.
In Medina,
they have of course. Of course, they were going to lose many things, yes. If the idols, well, they thought, if the idols are removed, then people who have idols here from other tribes, they wouldn't come for Hajj. And they were wrong, because whether Hajj, the idols were there or not, it was a custom which they could not leave the Arabs. Very interesting thing, Ibn Abi al-Awja and Abd al-Malik al-Misri and Abu Shakir al-Thani, these were people who did not believe in God at all. They were atheists at the time of Ibn Jafar al-Sadiq. And they used to perform Hajj. And someone came to Ibn Jafar al-Sadiq and said, apparently Ibn Abi al-Awja has converted to Islam. Ibn Sadiq said, no, this is his custom. He likes to come here, do these things, and then sit with the people, chat. And so it was a good... Good type of tradition which everyone performed. But yes, people in Mecca saw that if the idols are removed, they might not come, which was not right. Yes. So they had vested interest. Yeah, they had vested interest. Their business here. They might have lost their business. And this is what they said actually. That we are going to lose if we believe in you. And even after Islam, when Prophet said Mushrikun should not come to Hajj, he was criticized very much. That if they don't come to Hajj, where our business go? And because these people bring money, bring currency, so to speak, nowadays they say tourism is a source of income, and they said, well, this Hajj is a source of our income. You say Mushrikun shouldn't come to Hajj, and what should we do then? And the Quran, of course, answers, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِنَّمَا الْمُشْرِكُونَ نَجَسٌ They are najas, they are unclean. فَلَا يَقْرَبُ الْمَسْجِدَ الْحَرَامِ بَعْدَ عَامِهِمْ هَذَا After this year, which was the year in which the Prophet performed Hajj, they should not come to Hajj. And then he says, وَإِنْ خِفْتُمْ عَيْلَةً If you fear poverty, فَسَوْفَ يُغْنِيكُمُ اللَّهُ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ Allah will give from His own fadl, from His own grace to you. Do not be afraid. So this shows that still after Islam, they were afraid that if Mushrikun wouldn't perform Hajj, they would lose their business. And this is very strange, of course. Okay, let's move to Islam proper. Now, prophets of Islam. Well, I was born you know, on Amul Fil, the day of the year of the elephants, when the elephants of Abraha attacked Mecca. And as I mentioned when we were talking about his genealogy, many, many people, especially his fathers, they had pointed out that a prophet is going to come. Abdul Muttalib was respecting this child very much because he was saying to his children that this child is going to be respected very much, has a bright future, and he knew that he was going to become a prophet. And even Khadija mentions that when Prophet was born, when he was conceived, I saw a light emanating from me, illuminating the palaces of Busra in Sham. By God, I had not carried a child lighter and easier than him. When he was born, he put his hands on the earth and raised his head towards the sky. This is reported by Tabari and Ibn Ishaq. So even the birth was an extraordinary. The baby was an extraordinary baby. Now, we have heard this about A'imma alayhim as-salam, for example, when they were born, they were extraordinary. Amina. I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. So, the baby had assured his mother that this is an extraordinary baby. And of course, Amina as well knew that the child has a bright future, is going to become a prophet. And therefore, when an incident happened for him, when he was with Halima, and Halima rushed back to Mecca, brought the child with panicking and said, please take this child from me before he's hurt. When Amina asked what had happened and she explained, I will come to that story of course later on. She told Halima that don't worry, this child is exceptional. I have seen these signs from this child and therefore I'm not worried about him. So, right from the beginning he was different. However, one question we have to answer here. And that is, even before going to his foster mothers, we have to talk about the status of the prophets before prophethood. Of course, we can postpone this to later time. Yeah, maybe I speak about foster mothers and Inshira, and then I speak about his status, because that's a very, very important issue for us to analyze. Now, the foster mother, first she was fostered by Suwaiba, a slave maiden of Abu Lahab. Abu Lahab had some interest, well, liked Prophet. I don't know why, because even when Abdul Muttalib asked his sons who would foster after, of course, Abdullah passed away, and Abdul Muttalib himself wanted to pass away. When he asked his children, his sons, who would look after this son, the first person who actually suggested his approval or his interest was Abu Lahab. And of course, Abdul Muttalib was upset. He said, I'm not going to give this son of mine to you. Also, as a foster mother, he offered Tawaiba to milk him. And of course, it was before Halima had come to the city to take that child, that baby. And Tawaiba had milked Hamza as well. I said Abdul Muttalib married a woman simultaneously with his son Abdullah. And therefore, they had children of the same age, Hamza and the Prophet. So Hamza, Prophet's uncle, was almost the same age as the Prophet was. And in addition of being uncle and nephew, they were foster brothers as well. And they were very, very much attached to each other. And that's why the Prophet, I mean, you can imagine how Prophet was annoyed when Hamza was martyred on the day of Uhud. Now, of course, that was for a short while. They didn't want, of course, a woman from the city to foster the Prophet. They wanted a Bedouin or someone from outside tribes to come and take the Prophet to foster, as it was usual. Now, Bani Bakr ibn Sa'd, and that's why Halima is called Halima Sa'diyya, they usually came to Mecca every year to take the children and take them back to their tribe and foster them. And the reason they did this, because they were very poor, and of course the people of Mecca were very rich. So what they did, they took the children, they were given many gifts and also some sort of remuneration for what they did. And usually they looked for the richest people at the beginning, the richest people of Mecca, especially in Mecca, to foster their children. And then of course it was just chance who would get which family to foster their children. Now, when they came to Mecca, of course, Prophet was an orphan. He was an orphan. Abdul Muttalib was at the bottommost level of his ability in terms of wealth. He had lost everything. He didn't have much to offer. Amina couldn't offer much. She didn't have many. Her family were in Medina, of course. You know, her family lived in Medina. And therefore, they didn't want to take the Prophet. In a way, Halima came across the Prophet and Amina offered, that you take this son and foster him. And Halima said, no, thank you, I'll look for another child. And at the end, everyone had someone to take back to Bani Sa'd, except Halima. And when they were going back, she told her husband, well, it is very, very dishonoring if you go back without any child. I mean, everyone say, look, there should be something wrong with you. All of us have children, and you are going back without any child. So let's go and get that orphan. Well, they can't give us anything, but at least, we are not ashamed, we are not dishonored by going back without any child. So they went back to Amina and said, okay, give this child to us. And the story mentioned in Ibn Ishaq and Ibn Hisham is a very, very beautiful story. Well, you have heard about it. Halima and her husband, they were very poor. They had not eaten anything for days. And Halima didn't have milk to give even to her own child. And they came to the city in the hope that they get a child, they get a good food, they get a good wage, and then they go back and everything would be alright. As soon as they took the Prophet, Halima felt that her breasts were full of milk. And not only she fed her own child, she fed the Prophet, both of them became completely satisfied, satiated, and she was very amazed. She said, look, what has happened? And when they were coming, they had a mule or a donkey, which was almost dying. Could not walk, they couldn't ride on it. And when they went back to that mule or donkey, they saw, wow, this is a very, very active, very powerful, very strong type of donkey or mule. And on the way back, everyone was asking Halima, well, wait for us, isn't not the same mule on which you came? Have you changed or something? She said, no, I don't know what's happened. And in a way, the Prophet brought lots of barakah for them. Livestock, good farming, everything. And that is why after 2 years, when everyone had to return the children to their families, they went back and pleaded to Amina, let us keep this child because this is a source of barakah for us. And Amina said, okay, you can take him back and bring it when you bring him back when you want. And they did. And if nothing had happened, as we are going to explain, I think they would have kept the Prophet until the end of his life. Because they wanted to keep the Prophet in their midst. Now, what happened was something which terrified Halima. And that was a story which is mentioned in most of the books of history, that one day Prophet was playing with his foster brothers and sisters and other children in Bani Sa'd, and three men came with white clothes and they took the Prophet. And the children were very much terrified. They said, who are these men? Where have they come from? What they want to do with Muhammad? And even some of his foster brothers said to those men, of course there are different versions of this tradition, I will mention which one would be more correct, should be more correct afterwards. A foster brother of Prophet said to them, this is Sayyidul Quraysh, this has come from Quraysh, if you want to kill him or hurt him, do not do it, hurt one of us or kill one of us. And they did not listen to him. And what they did, now this version of the story, which I do not authenticate or approve of, I go according to this and then I mention the other version, says that the children saw that those three men made Prophet to lie and they tore open his chest completely from top to the navel. They opened the chest, they washed it inside, and then they brought out his heart and they washed the heart with something like snow. And then they took out a black thing from the heart. And after that, they put the heart in place. They somehow touched the chest. It came together. And then Prophet stood up. They kissed him. They respected him. And the children ran back to their parents. They said, come, Muhammad is killed. And of course, Bani Sa'd came back. And they didn't see anything. They just saw Prophet is very weak, sitting on the dust. And when they asked him, he said, no, they did not hurt me. And they were very afraid that these people were jinn who had actually either possessed him or had hit him. And that was the most terrifying thing that could happen for a child. They would have become epileptic, they would have become majnoon, and many other things. So Halima was afraid and he took the Prophet back. And this was when Prophet was 4 or 5 years old. She immediately took the Prophet back to Amina and said, I am afraid, I am somehow worried about this child. Please take him back. Now this is one version of the story. And this, many exegetes say that this is what Suratul Inshirah refers to. Alam nashrah laka sadrak. Did we not open your heart or your chest? Wa rafa'na laka dhikrak wa wada'na anka wizrak alladhi anqadha dhahrak. Now, who can say what is this story? Could it be true? I mean, such a thing happening to the prophets in his childhood. And what does it mean? People coming, tearing his chest, taking his heart out, washing it, in a way purifying it. And I have seen many people discussing the hadith, and in modern times, of course, most of the writers, they reject it. They say this could not be right. Even I have seen some ulama writing books of seerah, modern ulama, when they come to this hadith, they say, okay, this is a bit suspicious. We don't know whether this could be true or not true. And we don't know whether the Suratul Inshirah at all refers to this, because that talks about openness of the heart and these things. Any idea? Yes. Well, of course, human beings have different levels. And we know that every person has dark side in the soul. And maybe by purification. For example, the prophets didn't have any sins, but Allah still talks about purification of their soul. So it is possible for someone by washing, yes. So we have one lady here rejecting the hadith. Any other idea? Yes.
It implies that the Prophet was not of that level of purity before, that he had to be purified. So that's one of the things. Well, that if you say that, you say he has to be born not knowing that he's a prophet, he has to be purified by a demon that comes and takes something up from the men.
Mm-hmm.
He's somehow different to a normal person because he's been tampered with.
So you are suggesting that the hadith is could be right,
that's,
or
that's one problem with it.
Now let me mention the other version of the hadith. We are running out of time. The other version says that no one saw what happened. The children didn't see what happened. Now the children only saw the man coming. They didn't see what happened. They rushed back to their parents, and every corn came. They came when still those men were there, but they couldn't see them. And Halima started to speak to the Prophet, "What has happened to you? My dear son, you are weak here, you are alone here, that's why they hurt you." And those men were talking to the Prophet saying that they don't know how strong you are. That's why they say you are weak. And again Halima was saying something and the men were saying they don't know how respectful you are. That's why they think that you have been hurt. And the story says no one saw what had happened. Then Halima asked the Prophet, "What happened, my son?" And the Prophet said that, "Well, those three men came, they made me lie down, they opened my chest, they brought up my heart, and they washed it. And they put it in place, they kissed me, they respected me, and they went." Now, if this be the case, then there is a good justification, and that is, it was a mukashafa of the Prophet at that age. It didn't physically happen, but spiritually it happened. Allah purified the Prophet by those angels, in a way. However, Prophet had a mukashafa. This is what usually happens to mystics. They see, and in dream, you do lots of these things in dream, but sometimes the mystics see these things in when they are awake. For example, if Allah purifies your heart, you can see in the dream that someone took your heart and washed it. Isn't it? It's possible, isn't it? This is what Prophet saw as a mukashafa, as an unveiling of what had happened in reality. And then if this is the case, this is what Allama Tabatabai supports. He says, of course, the story in its physical form cannot be true. It's not something that we can accept, that in Sharah. However, if this is an unveiling for the 4 or 5 years old Prophet, or 4 or 5 years old Muhammad, peace be on him, then yes, this is a status for him. He saw what happened to him by those angels and those archangels probably who had came. Maybe Jibreel or some other angels, they had come. Allah had sent them to purify his heart, to take anything that might bring any type of doubt for the Prophet. Of course, we will discuss about this doubt later on, because this is something that which is very important when we come to the first revelation of the Prophet. Any doubt that might come to the heart of the Prophet when he would become, he would receive the revelation, he was purified. And Prophet saw in that way. As for example, you see in dream things which of course mean other things. And this was not meaning other things, it was just the physical manifestation of what had happened spiritually to the Prophet. A symbol. Well, a symbolic type of unveiling. Unveiling of for the Prophet, seeing that type of purification. And this is something which actually not only could be justified, but could be accepted very easily. That yes, of course Allah should have purified the Prophet. And add to that a hadith of Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and which is supported by other ahadith, and I will discuss it inshallah next week. Now I just mentioned the hadith, وَلَقَدْ قَرَنَ اللَّهُ بِهِ من لدن أن كان فصيما أعظم ملك من ملائكته يسلك به طريق المكارم وأحسن أخلاق العالم. Something like this. And right from his childhood, Allah had appointed one of his greatest angels to accompany him and to guide him what is good, what is bad. The best merits of human beings, that angel taught the Prophet, inspired him in a way. As we have in Surah Anbiya about some of the Anbiya of Bani Israel, وَأَوْحَيْنَا إِلَيْهِمْ فِعْلَ الْخَيْرَاتِ. We inspired them to do good things. And this is what happened with the Prophet and that angel. And apparently, that angel was appointed to him after his purification took place. And this was needed so that that angel could match with the Prophet and could accompany him all the time, could accompany his heart all the time. Maybe, of course, this is something that we can contemplate. Inshallah, we'll discuss this issue, which is a very important issue, next week. And then there comes question. If there was that angel, did he have free will? If he didn't commit anything, it was due to that angel. I know what goes in your mind. Inshallah, next week we'll discuss that. Yeah.